Call a meeting to order. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Monday, March 14th. And you have before you the minutes from our meeting of March 10th. Would someone move those minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murray moves those minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Those minutes are approved. Members, we have five bills for us today, and the first two bills we're going to hear together, Representative Morrow and Representative Lohmer. So if they would take the desk and... As a member of the committee, Representative Lohmer, maybe you could just move both bills at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 466 and House File 866.
Okay. Members, we intend to lay these bills over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. But, you may proceed.
Thank you very much. Since they're identical, I'll just do the overview. This bill appropriates money to the Department of Veterans Affairs for a grant to the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans.
Excuse me, Representative Lohmer, can someone figure out what our problem is? Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, we had the Transportation Committee in the same room earlier today, and it is a problem with the system that is being looked at by staff. It's not any one person's telephone this time.
Okay.
Oh, no, thank you very much.
Well, we'll have to just suffer the inconvenience of the background noise, but you may proceed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this bill appropriates $250,000 each year of the biennium. The appropriation in the second year, not being designated as a one-time appropriation, will be added to the agency's base amount for each year of the following biennium. So, Representative Morrow, did you want to add anything on the bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, thank you. This is a bill that's come through the legislature over a number of years. The Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans has facilities throughout the state, including Duluth, the Twin Cities, and in my area down in Mankato. In 2009, I brought this bill after MACV had a substantial budget cut. And then in 2010, Representatives Hamilton and Magnus brought similar legislation in order to help MACV provide help for homeless veterans throughout the state. And, Mr. Chair, I think probably the best person to describe MACV and what it does is Kathy Vitalis.
Ms. Vitalis, please identify yourself for the record, and then you may proceed.
Thank you. Kathleen Vitalis, President and CEO of Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, and thank you for having us here today. And again, the thumbnail of our organization, the material that you were passed out, that I will not go through in detail, is an overview PowerPoint that talks about our programs, but it talks about basically our mission, and it's homeless veterans and those in crisis. We do a lot of prevention work as well, so it's homeless and prevention. And last year, we assisted directly with our grants and funding over 800 veterans and their families representing 65 counties. And as I did with the Veterans Committee before this, I did look at each of your districts and I cross-referenced if we assisted veterans in your counties last year, and it is yes to each of you. And again, the definition of homeless, it takes on many forms, and a lot of this prevention work with crisis, they could be living in uninhabitable places. I mean, there's just a need in this state, and MACV is the nonprofit, and we fill gaps in services. As a statewide nonprofit, we're unique in the nation because we have implemented statewide. So we are able to leverage federal grants that come in all across the state, and we are able to leverage our dollars, and we also don't duplicate services. So the other piece of information, there's a new VA grant that has just come out, and we're trying to get some of that federal money into Minnesota. I also gave, as one of your attachments, a two-page letters of support. And there were more letters than this. This is what fit on two pages. And as you can see, many of these agencies that support us, for example, I'll point out Lutheran Social Services. There is their CORE program that is a great program through the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. We do not duplicate what they do. We refer to each other. So that is the key. And we focus on housing, employment, and legal assistance. And I think both urban and rural and the staff that I have, I look at them as these conduits to information. We are go-to people in the state because we know a lot about where to refer veterans and not necessarily us giving them direct service, but where can they get the help they're seeking. The last point I want to make before, and we do have a veteran testifying today, is that I talked a little bit about federal money. I'm well aware of what we're all facing in this state today with the budget. And we leverage federal money coming in, but we also have, as an example, a federal grant from the Department of Labor called the Homeless Veteran Reintegration Program Grant. That grant took 148 homeless veterans in the metro area. Now, this is one example, who were homeless, and in a year stabilized them with employment. And so instead of being on a variety of different programs or general assistance, they were now employed, they were stabilized, and they represented annual gross wages of $3.5 million. The other area where we bring money in is benefits. Now, many people connect veterans to benefits. But when we're targeting this subgroup, the less than 50% median income and less than 30%, connection to their benefits is something they very often have not ever done. They've never sought it out, and that stabilizes their income so that they can proceed without subsidies and they can get back to work. And that's the overview that I have. And we also have someone, I would like to also say we have some of my staff and some of the veterans in our programs with us today that have come down here in support of this.
Ms. Vitalis, could you give us a little bit of an overview in terms of your total budget and what percent of your budget this would represent?
Yes, our operating budget, and I can, if you're interested, we're audited, and we have a single audit process that's pretty extensive because we get federal funding. Our operating budget is about $1.8 million. We have assets. We have some of our own housing that we own, about $3.5 million worth of assets. And so this would represent of a $1.8 million budget. Most of the rest is made up of the federal grants and a lot of foundation support and support from companies and grants that way. So this would represent, I don't have my calculator, so we're at in the base for $500,000. And what Representative Morrow talked about is at one point in time we were at $1 million. And so we've gone way back, and each year I come and try to get us back to what's going to meet the need. And last year we got an additional one-time $100,000. This bill is for $250,000 for both years.
Thank you. The additional testifier, would you please identify yourself for the record, and then you may proceed.
My name is William Neiman, and I'm...
Would you please spell your name so we have it right here?
Name? The right name, put an N at the end. N-A-M-E-N.
Thank you.
About 10 years ago, I was basically homeless. I was... what you call a working homeless. I was in the Navy. Once I got in the Navy, I was working in the shipyards in California for about 10 years. And when the contract went out, and this is during about the 82 or so, we were having a recession kind of thing going on, and I got laid off. So I was sort of trying to look for work in that. But when I came home, I decided to come back here to Minnesota because this is where I'm from and this is my home. and I went to school. I graduated here. Figuring I could get a little help when and get back on my feet. Well, when I got here, I went through the welfare system, because at the time I was working day jobs. I was working, they were sending me all over, like Northern Track. I worked in the stockyards. I worked across the, on the other side of 494, where they used to make drinking troughs. You know, I have no problem. I didn't have no problem finding work or anything, but I wasn't. I didn't make enough to have a permanent resident. So when I went to welfare and that, they turned me down, because when I asked, I just needed enough to get an apartment. I couldn't get an apartment, so that made me homeless. Since I wasn't married, I didn't have children, I couldn't, you know, I was paying child support at the same time, so I was sort of living on like $97 a month back then. So that wasn't enough to hardly get food or a place to stay, just barely get enough to maybe buy soaps and maybe toothpaste. So basically I was struggling, trying to, you know, keep a job, pay my dues to my child I had at the time, I didn't know I had, and just existing. So basically I was existing just day by day and sleeping in Minnesota. The winters are very hard, so I was sleeping in, you know, people's cars, garages, couches when I can get it, when it was warm enough. When it rained, you know, I never had, you know, dry clothing. I always had, say, with the little bit of money I did have, I would put it in the dryers for food. Sometimes when I got off work, if I didn't make it to the churches and stuff, I would dig in the trash cans and find food. So I can have enough strength to make it for the next day. I never had problems, like I said, with working, but doing that for about 10 years, your hopes and dreams started fading. So when, on top of that, I was, increasingly drinking, because I'm like getting depressed with being homeless. I lost a lot of will, lost a lot of faith. And one day I decided, I had enough. I was staying down here at the Minnehaha Park, down here sleeping, and it was because we just had the trolley going, so I can sort of sneak on the trolley, get to work, you know, sneak off and hope we don't get caught, kind of deal. And I just got tired of doing it. One night I was to the point to where I was just so wet, I was cold, I was tired. I decided I was going to jump off the Ford Bridge. But before I did that, I sort of prayed to my God and the Lord, you know, and I went to sleep. The next day, I was sort of pondering and sitting on a rock looking at the Mississippi River. It was a sunny day, I remember this day, and a guy named Bill Johnson came out there and was asking me if I was a veteran. And at first, I thought he was after my drink there, and I wasn't planning to share with anybody. But he was pretty much serious. And he says, "Well, how would you like to have three cots and a meal, three meals and a cot?" And I said, "Well, that sounded pretty good. Cause that's that three meals and a cot is like driving a Rolls Royce, you know, down the street." When I actually told me to meet a man down at Catholic Charities, which is off of Chicago down there in Minneapolis, and he talked about what the program was about and stuff, and I didn't know, you know, anything about the program, and I didn't really care at the time because my self-esteem was really bad anyway, and I didn't care. And when people tell you they're going to help you, you know, and it falls through, you don't believe anybody anymore. You know, you got tired fighting the system. So he sent me up to St. Cloud to get myself straightened up and everything and for 28 days. And basically, I was getting all the best medical I could get, you know, get my medications, blood pressure, the whole works, get fed, got some weight. And at the time, I was sort of thinking that I was, I feel pretty good, I can take off. But they also had he came up there and told me about a program that they were having down here in Minneapolis. It was called MACP. And it's a 2.5-year program. Since I didn't really have anything else to do, and had no place to really go, I had no house to go to or anything, I figured I would give it a try and give it a go. When I got down here, they had they taught me how to react with society, living skills that I had lost over the years being homeless. I mean, being homeless, sort of do some of the etiquettes that your mother used to teach you when you were little. They got me further medical help assistance, psychiatrist, working on my bad drinking habit at the time. I went to AA meetings and that got me going. Got me started on a job program called CWT at the time, where you go out and you work part time. You learn how to work with people again and talk to people again and just be part of society. During that time, about 2.5 years, I had almost about 2 years in, and they had a job opening, which I didn't think I was going to get. At that time, I would take any job. They had this opening in engineering, which was a pipe fitting job. And then since I was a boiler repairman in the Navy, that's sort of down my line. And so I signed up for the job, and the next thing I knew, I was a supervisor. They hired me as a supervisor. I couldn't believe I was a supervisor, because I've never been a supervisor any job I ever had. I never had that kind of responsibility. After about 3 years after that, I got married. And I got married. Next thing I knew, I bought a house out here in Eagan. It's on the lake, which I wanted. Got two dogs. I got a son that's still in high school. Now all I have to do is wait for my white picket fence, and I'll be set. I can't express the feelings that MACP, you know, did for me. I mean, I was down and out. Most people would have let me go, you know, because I wasn't worth trying to save or help or anything like this. I look back right now. I look back and see where I was and who I am today. I'm surprised I'm still here. Because literally, the way I was. There's words I cannot describe it. Right now, I feel so. I'm so happy. I'm so glad to be alive. I'm glad. I can't explain it. It's just it's one of the biggest gifts that you can ever have. You know, you think about Christmas. What was your best toy you ever got? That's even 10 times more than that. I give back to society now. I pay my taxes. I do everything that a normal person can do. Without this program, which I really strongly wish we had more of them, it helped me so much. And now I just got my 10-year pin for working at the Veterans Hospital here, and I got about 10 more, and I have my 20, and I can retire, you know, after I pay off my house, and the future is really looking really, really bright, and I can't say enough about MACV. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Nauman, please thank you very much for being here today. Thank you for sharing your wonderful story that you have shared with us, and thank you for your service to this country.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on this either bill? Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing me. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International and our Family Centers. Children's Hope International and our Family Centers is a private nonprofit that's been in operation since 1974 with core areas in economic development, education, healthcare, housing, justice, public policy, technology, and victim services. I'm also here for the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. We have Asian Pacific Islander service organizations of over 15, but we also include realtors, lenders, developers, and others in the housing industry, and we're growing. We service the over 210,000 API community since the last 2000 census, but we also do services for other Minnesotans, all other Minnesotans. We are currently working on a target of 400,000. I'm also a member of the Homeless Coalition, which has over 150 member organizations, including churches, working on the homelessness issues, and many of us do serve veterans. As far as the Wilder research, there are over 10,000 homeless people, 19% are veterans, 50% are children. And also, the definition of homelessness means that you could be living with a relative or friends and then you're not paying rent, versus, you know, being living in the streets and so forth. So there are many who they have not distinguished between the difference. Last year, we tried to draft policy legislation that would house everybody just by doing things differently, but there was opposition to that, and I'm hoping that we can still work on that. All of the organizations need funding. Most of the organizations go to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for funding for the homelessness, which goes to the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. Some organizations have asked for earmarks through the Health and Human Services Committee. There's one large organization that has been asking for earmarks through all the different committees, including veterans, and plus they go through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency competition rounds. Now, I'm a former corporate auditor for companies, which includes a Fortune 500 company, a former financial executive. I've been a general contractor and still am a former developer, realtor, and lender. I have my MBA, I've been a CPA, and I'm a certified housing counselor and educator. And I've done grant reviews then of all these different programs and agencies. I shouldn't say all the different ones. I've done a number of different ones. My family, relatives, and I have had a service of serving the United States of America, including many who are veterans. And we have pioneered in a number of areas regarding doing things better, innovating, and so forth. Now, the reason why I bring this to your attention is that we are also working on a project to do things better, differently, more faster, more efficiently, cheaper, and so forth, which would yield a return on investments and serve larger populations. We also have some that are trying to generate revenue. On the homelessness issues, we have served, and I have several cases now where we're helping World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, Vietnam, Persian Gulf, and Iraq veterans. So we're not unfamiliar with the issues, any help that the committees can give to any of the organizations that service the homeless would be helpful. As far as the suicide prevention, that also comes under Health and Human Services. So there's been a number of cases. I myself have worked on a number of cases on that as far as suicide prevention, preventing evictions, and working on several with, for stopping foreclosures and preventing and working with bankruptcy cases. So with our court experience, we're also dealing with them as far as court advocacy. And so I just call your attention to the many wonderful organizations out there that you've probably heard of if you've been in some of these other committees that would also like you to consider them and consider that we help the veterans too and how we might all work together. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Anyone else who wishes to be heard? If not, Representative Gauthier has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not so much a question as a comment. First of all, sir, thank you for your service to our country, and you are an inspiration to many people, and I want to acknowledge that. I also want to thank Representative Lomar and Morrow for taking this forward and important. I just want to comment from Duluth perspective that we are the recipients of MACV programs, and they are very instrumental in my community in addressing veterans' issues in homelessness. And also having experience of nearly 30 years in social services and mental health, I know that one of the things that is unique about a veteran's program is they need to be administered and brought to veterans, to veterans. And that's key, especially with people dealing with mental illness and post-traumatic stress disorder, TBI. And I think MACV does a great job, and I would thank you for this program and keep it up and be very supportive of this being laid over and being in the omnibus bill.
Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Vitalis, what point do you usually screen people? I mean, the DD-214s, do you get those in early on?
Ms. Vitalis?
I'm sorry. Yes, sir. Veteran eligibility is with the DD-214, but we don't determine eligibility. We work with the VA or the county Veterans Service Officers or the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs to look at eligibility, that it can be complicated.
Representative Leidinger.
And then, you know, I heard the figure of 19% of the veterans are homeless?
The figures that I have nationwide is that 16% of all homeless, and these come from a variety of the VA websites and the information that is out there, 16% of all homeless, includes women and children, are veterans. And nationwide, 33% of male homeless are veterans. And we follow very closely. I don't have the Wilder study statistics, but those percentages follow very closely in Minnesota as well. And in Minnesota, the Wilder study every 3 years also was, when they counted, it was 700 homeless on any given night.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative,
I want to check those figures. That's all I had, sir. I know we got to move on.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Vitalis, can you tell me a little bit about the other types of grants that are available to your organization? I mean, I'm hearing your numbers of what you're doing for funding. I'm looking at other numbers indicating the total amount that your group has. What kind of the grant making do you engage in? Is it from public and private sector sources?
Yes.
Ms. Vitalis?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative. We do... I use every source that is available, and I'll start just with the federal sources that are available through the Department of Labor. We have their Veterans Employment and Training Service. We've had a grant with them for over 10 years. That's one of our major sources for employment. And by the way, my regional director just came up to me and told me that since July to now, under this grant, we have placed 80 homeless veterans into employment. So those are our current numbers under that grant. That's the Department of Labor. We have a couple VA grants. That one of the grants is a grant and per diem that runs our Building 47, 13-bed residential facility. We have the funding through the state. We also had some of the ARRA, HPRP funding that came through. We went after that as well in certain communities. That was extremely complicated to get, but we were able to get some of that funding as well. ESG, Emergency Food and Shelter, and then my list of foundations. We work with many foundations and corporations for funding, and I can't leave out all of the wonderful veteran service organizations, the auxiliaries that provide funding to us.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Vitalis, is there any part of that, particularly talking about that last part with private foundations, does any of that depend on your ability to get grant in, this grant from the state?
Ms. Vitalis.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative. I don't have the state dollars tied directly as a match to something else, but I very much use it, especially with the federal grants. They're all wondering, well, what does the state do? What is the state's portion? And then my private foundations and corporations as well. It's kind of the ante in that, well, we can fill gaps as well, but I'm always asked, and what is the portion that is coming through the state?
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Ms. Vitalis, and the testifiers for your presence here today. Representative Lohmer renews the motion, and I will lay both of these bills over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
The next bill is House File 756, Representative Stensrud. And Representative Stensrud, if you want to move your bill.
Yes, I would like to, Mr. Chairman, move House File 756.
And you have an amendment, one amendment or two amendments?
Yes. I have one amendment to get it in shape.
Okay. And that's DE2?
Yes, it is.
Okay. You want to move DE2?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I would have moved amendment DE2.
Okay, at the request of the author, he is asking us to get it in the shape that he would like to present it. All in favor of DE2, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The bill is amended with DE2. You may proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 756 is a relatively simple concept and a simple bill. And it simply gives direction to the commissioner to design a performance appraisal system for the employees in the executive branch. And it's based on three areas of performance. It's really individual goals for the employee. It's the individual contribution towards the department goals. And third would be the performance of the entire department or agency the employee works for. And the wording in the bill actually say that no less than 5% of the employee's salary would be affected. And it's a concept that is throughout private industry and most Fortune 1000 companies. Most companies all have an appraisal system for their employees, and they look at performance and rewards those who do really well, and it doesn't reward as much those who struggle at their jobs, and it always encourages, you know, peak performance. So I think human nature shows us that we all know there are varying levels of work performance. So this begins to allow the supervisors to reward the employees in a way that reflects, you know, how well they do. And also it works, again, for the management, because the managers are also going to be on a performance-based pay. So it's going to be in their best interest to work with employees so that they can all do well. I knew that this was coming before the committee tonight, and it was interesting that a Rasmussen report just came out today into my email saying that the headline is, Americans say pay should be based on performance instead of education and seniority. And when you read down and then into the first or second paragraph, it says, most American adults think how much money an individual is paid should depend on what they get done on the job rather than their educational background or how long they've worked for the company. And it goes on to explain a few different parameters. And I think that that really echoes the sentiment of those taxpayers that are out there. It's just a reasonable approach that we should begin to take into effect in the executive branch. So if there are questions, I would be happy to take those.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stensrud, is there a Senate companion to this?
Representative Stensrud.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erdahl. Yes, there is, and I believe it's being carried by Senator Perry.
Other questions? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stensrud, I want to understand the difference between your bill as amended and as it came to the committee.
Sure.
So as I read the DE-2, you're simply saying that 5% of the employee's salary must be dependent on performance appraisals. And we had discussion, I think, in government operations about the fact that previous version of the bill first cut 5% of salaries and then said it, and you get a 5% bonus potential. And it sounds like you're doing the same thing. You've just changed the language a bit. Is that correct?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Wink. I would say that that's not precisely what the language says. I guess that would be a misunderstanding. I mean, that would be assuming that everyone gets a zero on their performance appraisal. So I did change the language, though, and I think it's important to point out, in working with, I talked with MAPE representative and discussed, but I made a slight change. If you look under line like 118, 119, it talks about, I mean, this is not immediately, it's for the next contract period, and it does call for the commissioner to negotiate in the collective bargaining agreement so that this performance appraisal would be up to 5% of their pay, and that would be collectively bargained so that this appraisal would be part of the collective bargaining for the next contract period.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stensrud, it says on 2.1 that it must be at least 5%, and I guess if we, in the next contract period, included a 5% pay increase, then the 5% bonus would be all new money. I suspect that by the time we get bills passed out of the committee and onto the floor, there won't be money for a 5% salary increase. So practically speaking, isn't this going to be reducing the salary base by 5% and then making people eligible for at least 5% in a bonus? And isn't it almost certainly going to be a 5% reduction with the 5% bonus?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler. Again, I would hope that there are a number of employees who would do well on their performance appraisal. We have a lot of good, dedicated employees in state government who are, meeting and exceeding expectations. So for those folks, they're going to, that will be reflected, in their appraisal. So I guess you're maybe a little more pessimistic whether there's more money or whether there may be negotiations and contracts. There may not be more money, in your opinion. There may or there may not be. I guess I left that open.
Well, Mr.
Representative Winkler.
Chair, Representative Stensrud. Well, I'm really quite confused because this committee has a 50% target reduction, and I understand that not all of that will be straight out of the state agencies that over which this committee has jurisdiction, but a big part of that will be finding cost savings across all state departments, all state agencies. And the only way to really do that, I'm going to guess, is going to be through state employees. So there's just really no set of circumstances under which this legislature is going to be appropriating money to state agencies to give state employees a 5% raise. So there's almost no scenario under which they're not going to be held flat or do worse. And so this 5% bonus system really is taking 5% out of what they're making now and then saying, now you have an opportunity to earn it back. And some may do it, many may do it, all may do it. We don't know. But just to be clear, you're not saying we're going to give you a 5% bonus for doing well, you're saying we're going to give you a cut, and then you have an opportunity to earn that cut back. Isn't that really the case?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Winkler. I think it's somewhat in semantics. You use the word cuts because that's, you know, an easy word to throw around, but I think we really want to give opportunity to the management structure and to the whole culture in state government so that we can begin to look at, you know, how are they paid and how are they performing and get a pay for that. You know, it's done all across America. It's not really a shocking sort of a concept. You know, I've never actually had a job where I didn't have, far more than 5% of my personal pay reflecting, you know, how well I did at that job. And I think that this really reflects just a start in communicating that sort of a concept into our executive branch. So some may perceive it as a cut. Some may think that it's a great opportunity for them to be rewarded for a good performance and good reflection on their work.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand, Representative Stensrud. Is there any scenario where an employee will ever make anything more than what they're making now? Because typically, when you think of a bonus, it's you take your base, and if you do well, if you're rewarded for your effectiveness on the job, then you get a bump for that. And you don't know what it's going to be. You know, around this time of year, companies are coming out with their performance-based bonuses. My wife just got one last week, did very well. We were happy about that. But that was on top of her base. They didn't say, first we're going to cut 5% of your salary, and then we're going to decide if you get that 5% back. So you're not just introducing a concept of performance pay, which is a different issue. You're making a cut and then giving people an option of earning it back. Isn't that what the bill does that we're going to be voting on at some point?
Representative Stensrud.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, I think if you would talk to those in your district, and as I've talked with those in mine, many companies and many folks have lost their jobs or have taken significant pay cuts. And they oftentimes are working with their employers and with their division to improve their performance. So I don't think, you know, there may be situations where they don't receive a full, full high performance appraisal. And sure, in that case, they may experience a reduction and they don't get their full 5% pulled back, if you will. It doesn't say that it's an annual event. It really makes no mention of that. It gives some leeway to the department heads and with the commissioner to design a plan that would be acceptable for them. And it does include collective bargaining in the design of this plan. So I think it's a very reasonable approach that most of corporate America would look at without a second glance and assume that this is a very reasonable approach to move forward, in particular in this economy.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to belabor this, but Representative Stensrud, you're either deliberately not understanding the question or you don't understand it genuinely, I guess. The question is not, do we have performance pay? The question is not, do we have wage cuts or salary freezes? The question is not, is this like what the private sector does? The question is, doesn't your bill mechanically cut 5% and then give people a chance to earn the 5% back?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler. Yes, I guess moving forward,
thank you.
There is opportunity in negotiations to design a plan. And yes, there are situations where if someone doesn't meet minimum performance standards for their individual goals and does not meet minimum standards for performance for their goals towards the agency's goals, and if the agency is doing very poorly and miss their objection or their objectives, then yeah, there is a scenario where they would not get an increase. And some would say, by looking at it, well, justly so. You know, if you miss on every single criteria for performance that's agreed upon and designed by the commissioner, then that would be the outcome.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stensrud, I guess I don't have any objection to evaluations. That's not my issue. I work for county government. I got evaluated all the time. For part of my career. But you did say it's 5% holdback, correct?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gauthier. It would have to be designed by the commissioner, and I would give them the leeway to do work it out however they work it out. I don't want to put, you know, my words into the commission plan. I'll leave it to be designed by the commissioner.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gauthier.
If you look at line 21, you say negotiate collective bargaining agreement. What if there isn't an agreement to have this in there? Then what does your bill do?
Representative Stensrud.
Because that confuses me.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stensrud.
Perhaps Mr. Shepard could help shed some light on this. I'm not sure. If you'd repeat your question for me one more time.
Well, in line 1.21, you talk about negotiating the collective bargaining, the commissioner shall, blah, blah, blah. And I'm saying, you know, negotiations in a collective bargaining agreement are with two parties. And if the other party doesn't agree and we've passed this bill, I'm wondering what the effect is on collective bargaining. It's very confusing to me.
Mr. Shepard, did you have something to contribute here?
Mr. Chair, members, I think the bill addresses collective bargaining in two places. The first one is the one that Representative Gauthier pointed out on the first page in paragraph B. It's actually on line 1.19 of the Delete Everything Amendment DE2. And that requires that the evaluations would be based on the factors that are consistent with those listed above in paragraph A and other factors that the commissioner would negotiate in collective bargaining. So that would be the factors that would be considered. And then on the second page, at the top of the second page, the statute requires that at least 5% of an employee's salary would be dependent on the performance appraisals. And then it states that implementation would be determined through collective bargaining.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Shepard. Correct me if I'm wrong here. But if we're directing the commissioner to negotiate this, and if the other party says no, where does this bill leave us? That's my confusion. We're in a quandary because the other party has the right to say no. Is that correct, Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll state my understanding, and if Representative Stensrud or others have other understandings, they could please correct me. That I think on the first part, on page one, that the performance appraisal and bonus system would have to include the three statutory criteria. There is room, if both parties agree, as you indicated, for other factors to be considered.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Shepard, so what you're telling me is basically we've handed this thing and said this is the way it is and you don't get to bargain on it. Is that what this bill does? Because I'm not understanding.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gauthier, I think that the bill in paragraph A lists three components that must be in the performance system regardless of anything in collective bargaining. That part is not negotiable. They would everything would have to include those three points. Then in paragraph B, it states that individual pay increases would be based on those statutory factors plus any other factors that may be negotiated if the parties agreed on them.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Representative Stensrud, if I get this right now, we've mandated a performance system on three criteria. We're saying you have to do 5% cutback. When do we begin to negotiate in good faith under your bill?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds somewhat like a rhetorical question. I mean, I guess I have better faith in collecting. I think they can come to some sort of consensus when the parties get together. I think we've just laid out a plan moving forward for the next period. It really takes a simple concept that's used all across America by millions of Americans, probably a majority of the entire country, and try to
really begin the process of pulling that together with our with one executive branch here in the Minnesota in the state of Minnesota. So I guess I would hope that as we begin negotiations and begin moving forward, that we can start having this sort of approach into how our folks are compensated.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gothier.
Final comment, I guess, is no, I didn't mean it as rhetorical at all. It seems to me we've had a system in place, and though we may talk about reform, and I'm even open to that, I don't have a problem with that. But we're shoving down the other party that we have to negotiate, saying this isn't negotiable, and to me that's not in good faith. And I guess, you know, when I was on city government, never once did we as a council legislate to the administration what they would and would not negotiate in contracts. What we did do was review contracts, and then we voted yes or no based on what was negotiated between the administration and the unions. And let me tell you, my city doesn't have a administration that's very favorable towards unions. But they did it in good faith, and this just confuses me. I have no problem talking about reforms, but if we're going to mandate to the administration and to the employees, this is our negotiating. That's not negotiating. And I guess, you know, I'm glad I live in Minnesota and not the rest of America, if that's the rest of the way the rest of America does. But I know in Duluth, Minnesota, we don't do it this way. Because we value our employees and what they have to say.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at this bill under Section 2. This is authorizing the executive branch to go ahead and construct this performance bonus component as part of the overall compensation earned during that biennium. I mean, that's giving them the authority. I guess the question I'm going to ask is, can that also be bargained away? I mean, is it part of the idea of the bonus portion of this? Is that something that could be within the bargaining between two parties? Something that could be bargained away. And I would say that, you know, in the interest of trying to move forward and getting a system of pay which has incentives in there, you know, we wouldn't really want to bargain that away. This is a great first step of getting a compensation system that is much like that's out in the private sector, and really giving people incentive to really do their very best on their job. So, and to me, this is the paragraph that gives the authority, I don't think, is it something that can be put on the table then during a negotiating session between two parties? Would that be your intent or not your intent? It's really, it looks like you're trying to insert real reform here.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Leidiger. No, that's exactly my intent, just to put in some new ideas and new reform, I guess, into how we compensate folks at in state government. So you're accurate on that account.
I gotta support it the way it is, Mr. Chairman. And you know, to Representative Winkler's point, I mean, I think you bring up some good points, but I don't believe that this is that unclear. I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. To your point, each contract starts anew. So some people might make less money. Some might their base might be less. Some people might have a base that's actually more. The whole idea is, it's that 5% additional dollars that these people could get. That's the way I read this. Am I wrong,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Stansrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Leininger. I think there are, you know, in bargaining, there could be cases where a base salary would increase. Now, will it this next contract period? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, we are in tough times, so that may not be the case. But I think moving forward, the intention is that there is a salary, and 5% of that is going to be, you know, performance-based. So what someone made, it may actually increase in some areas depending on how that contract is negotiated.
Representative Leidiger?
There are going to be all new contracts. So we don't know what the baseline, I mean, we can't sit here and predict what they're going to be. They're yet to be negotiated. Some may be negotiated lower and some may be negotiated higher. It is not a foregone conclusion that everybody gets an increase all the time. I mean, I know in my company, when I negotiated contracts with my guys, we actually paid less for various reasons, but it ensured that everybody had a job, and they were very satisfied by having that job, especially in these economic times. And I believe that that's what your intent is with this bill, and I like the bill.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to clear up a few confusions for myself. Representative Stensrud, first of all, the effective date on this bill, it says effective July 1 for employees covered by collective bargaining agreement. This section applies to collective bargaining agreements entered into on or after this date. Therefore, Representative Stensrud, if any of the collective bargaining units were to create a contract before the state, they would not have to abide by this agreement, and they would not, and that would not be something covered regarding the budget that's forthcoming. Am I correct about that?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Banyan. I believe you are correct, but I would maybe just confirm with Mr. Shepard on that one, but I believe you're
Mr. Shepard. Mr. Shepard, if one of the units bargaining with us decided to bargain for the upcoming biennium and negotiate an agreement before June 30 of this year, if we pass this, they would not be covered by that.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, I believe that's correct. I think there is a slight ambiguity here in that the legislature has to approve collective bargaining agreements, and the effective date doesn't, perhaps due to an oversight on my part, address what entered into means. But I think, assuming that it were entered into and the legislature approved it, then I believe you're correct.
Right. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And you bring me to a second point, which I think gets to the question that or questions that Representative Gauthier mentioned. We can address these things as a legislature. We, in essence, can say things like, you know, when you come to work, you ought to wear a tie. You know, when you come to work, you ought to be on time. And those are things that we can simply say. We represent the citizens and taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. So when we negotiate a contract on their behalf, as their agents with workers who work for this state, okay, if we pass this bill into law and then we get a contract back that does not meet this, then I think it's up to us to say we don't approve this contract because this contract does not abide by the wishes that we expressed when we passed this bill and the governor signed it into law. So it's on us. It's not on anybody else. It's our responsibility. At the end of the day, the buck stops here. That's what your election certificate says. So I don't necessarily know what happens if the commissioner decides to come back and say, well, we negotiated, it didn't work out. We could go back and say, go back and try it again. Because we passed this bill and we meant it. And we can either choose to do that, or we can abdicate our responsibility. We can pass laws that we end up deciding not to follow. That would be a shame. But that's possible. Now, let me get to this question of the freeze or not freeze. And I think I got some of this out of Representative Leidegger's questions. But let me ask you this first. Suppose somebody is subject to this new contract. We negotiate that there's going to be a zero overall increase. Take Representative Winkler's prognosis of where we might be going. And so the last 5% depends on a performance level. Representative Stensrud, if they do not work well enough to receive all 5% back, where would the money go?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Banyan. I am going to assume that that's going to, you know, savings it will be in that department under unpaid wages, I imagine.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Stensrud, because that opens up a possibility. Here's the way I thought about it, and when Representative Winkler was talking, I wrote down sort of a simple scenario. Suppose I'm the manager of a department in state government that has a $2 million payroll. Under this rule, $1.9 million is going to now, if we say no wages are going up, so we're going to hold the overall wage bill constant, $1.9 million now is going to be base pay, and that last $100,000 is going to be available for performance bonuses. Would it not be possible for some people to receive a smaller than 5% of that amount and some people to receive a greater than 5% amount so that on average they would end up with that 5%?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Banyan. I thought through that scenario for quite a while, and I have actually never been in an organization where they paid out for performances where they didn't know what that payout was going to be, and they always split it amongst those. Some got zero, some got, you know, if you had a 5% across the board, half the people got zero, half the people could get a 10% raise or you know, a payout. So I philosophically would not be opposed to that. I mean, it's just not about necessarily saving money. It's about changing the culture to match that in industry that rewards for performance. You know, the strongest and the best should be rewarded the most. So, you know, this bill does not specifically address that, but I certainly would consider that moving forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. My last point, and thank you for your patience. I mean, that's in fact the way it's done, at least in some academic organizations. I know the dean tells a department chair, you've got this pile of money to give merit pay or performance bonuses to your faculty, make a proposal to me on how you will divide it up. Now, this is private sector. This is not union. How it works within a union structure is going to be very different, and I recognize that, and I think we all should recognize that. But there's a scope there. There's a model there that works where you could imagine having overall the same level of pay, but those who are performing better being able to obtain raises and other folks not. And that seems to me to be the spirit of your bill, and in that sense, I support it.
Representative Leidegger.
Representative Banyan brought up a point, and I just want to follow up on it. Could another scenario? Could a executive choose to reapport in this bill? Could he reapportion it? Of course, I don't. It doesn't read where he could really pay out more than 5%. But is there if no one in his if no one within the department got more than, let's just say, 3%, okay, across the board. Could the remainder of those dollars then be used by the discretion of the department head? Could they go back then to the general fund? I mean, does this give any options? Do you believe the bill give any options to do something like that? I don't read in here rigidity on what can be done with the dollars, or is this that all the dollars need to be spent? I'm not sure I really should have gone into this, but he brought up the point, and I wanted to follow up on that.
You're asking Representative Stensrud?
You can try it.
Sure. Okay. Representative Stensrud.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidinger. I don't know that I tried not to tie down so many of the specifics, I guess, in the overall plan. I don't know if it would allow for that.
Okay.
That's fair.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stensrud, reading your bill, I don't see anywhere where it allows a department to pool this money. So it really is about individuals, right?
Representative Stensrud.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gauthier, that is how it reads today. That is correct.
Okay. And I don't see anywhere where it says that a supervisor can give from 0 to 5%. It doesn't say I can give 3%. Says at least 5% of their pay shall be based on performance.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gauthier, yes, you have read that correctly. It says that this performance appraisal will pay out, if you hit those categories, it would be up to 5%, I guess, as a total.
Okay, thank you, Representative Stensrud.
Members, I understand the questions or confusion that there may be here with the language, and I think it's because we've got several elements that we're putting into one. The performance appraisal and bonus pay system is one, but then we're saying also that certain aspects of that have to be in the collective bargaining agreements. Then we're also saying that an employee in the executive branch may not receive an increase in salary or wages based on cost of living, et cetera, unless they have satisfactory performance. And then we're saying at least 5% of the employee's salary must be dependent on performance appraisal. Putting all those things in one bill certainly lends itself to how do all of those different provisions interact with one another, and how do they all come together in the collective bargaining process? And I guess I would challenge anyone, if you've got some suggestions on how some of that confusion could be clarified, it would be good to hear. And we are going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to point out the language that it already exists in law, which is the section of law says that the commissioner must maintain an appraisal system, and then your stricken language on line 1.20 to 1.22 says collective bargaining agreements are encouraged to and may provide for pay increases based on employee work performance. So we're not introducing a new concept in law. What we're basically doing is subverting the collective bargaining process and telling the commissioner what they have to stick in here and what they don't. And I think that's the challenge, is that you don't really want to acknowledge that this is a 5% pay cut in order to create a 5% bonus system, and you're putting a lot of other things into law when, in fact, we already have something in law that encourages a performance pay system. And if we don't have one, I would submit that maybe it was because Governor Pawlenty didn't want one. If we do have one, which I suspect we have in many agencies, we don't really need this new language. The only thing I see here is a way to get around collective bargaining. And, based on that, I think the simplest thing to do is just not do this. And if you don't like the contract that comes back, to Representative Banyan's point, don't approve it. If you get one without collective without performance pay, vote no. You have the majority. You can kill it. And you can send that signal. You don't need the confusion of this bill in order to achieve that result.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a question for Mr. Shepard. Because basically it has said this is going to be in the collective bargaining agreement. And if the employees through their union decide not to agree to that, the existing contract then prevails. Is that not correct?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, I think that there is a question. If your question is with respect to the transition from
if there's
the current
no agreement.
Contract in effect today, this biennium?
I'm saying if there's no agreement with this provision, and there's no agreement, the existing contract prevails.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, the collective bargaining agreements that the state currently has with its employees generally contain a provision that the terms of the current contract remain in effect until either a new contract is agreed to or one of the two parties takes action to terminate the old contract. So under the current contracts, yes, the terms would remain in effect until a successor agreement is reached.
Thank you.
Okay, members, we will. Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment. I'll claim the A2 amendment. I think it's the only other amendment here.
You're moving the A2?
I move the A2.
Okay, do you want to speak to it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this takes the exact same language that is on line 1.9 to 1.15 of the DE2 and applies the same principle to those any entity whatsoever who contracts with the state. So any private sector, public sector, anyone who contracts with the state, they too get 95% guaranteed, but 5% have to be based on the exact same three factors. That's it.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simon, I guess I would not be in favor of that amendment.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Stensrud on this. I don't know that we should consider this now without actually taking a deeper look at current procurement guidelines, having been on the other side of contracts. I think this is a dramatic reduction. The contracts that I did, 100% of every dollar we billed to the state was at risk based on performance. And so it seems to me that we'd be allowing even as low as a 6% or guaranteeing up to 95%. Every contract I ever did was deliverable-based, where you had very tight deliverable acceptance criteria. If it was an individual hourly basis, the individual was reporting time cards, and their billings were always signed off on by a supervisor. So I just can't imagine that we would guarantee 95% of an outside contract. I don't think that would even hold up under existing procurement guidelines. So I think if the intent is to make sure that there's some component of a contractor's billings at risk, I think we've got a much stronger criteria in law right now, and this would be a radical diminishing of that and exposing the state to extremely high risk if we were required to guarantee a 95% payment and only have 5% at risk.
Hey, Mayor.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out that the language is precisely the same as it is in the underlying bill, which is at least 5%. So it's not guaranteeing 95%. It could be more than that that can be withheld based on these three criteria. So I'm just trying to make sure we have the parallel language.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, 95, 50, whatever the number, I just cannot imagine we put the state at risk and just guarantee payment on contracts at that level. And I think some of Representative Simon's comments, I think, speak to the reasonableness of Representative Stensrud's bill, that we would put a fairly modest amount of 5% into a performance-based arrangement for our employees is not a big thing, especially when outside contractors in general are pretty much 100% at risk for performing according to their contracts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, now I'm really confused, because it's okay to have a contract and then we're going to just say, no, we're going to take 5% away from you because you're employees, but it's not okay to say that to people that outside that we contract with. So what is good for the goose isn't good for the gander. I guess I just don't understand the lack of fair play here.
Representative Winkler.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I guess I'd like a roll call on the A2 amendment. And second, Representative Downey, we're not guaranteeing anything. I really don't see the difference. If we're saying that all employee contracts have to have at least a 5% bonus pay system, and now we're saying that all outsourcing contracts have to have a 5% bonus system. Again, at least, we're not guaranteeing anything. We're saying a minimum standard for all contracts has to be at least 5% based on performance. That's what the bill says about employees. Why would we not say that about outside vendors? It could be 100. There's no limit. It says at least. That sounds like a minimum standard. What's wrong with that?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the comments that have been made. Again, you could easily infer from this, and in a procurement, offer a guarantee of 95%. That is an off-the-charts guarantee relative to current procurement standards, and I think if we were to equalize this right now in the existing world, where outside contracts are, in my mind, 100% at risk based on the performance of the contractor, we'd be putting 100% of state employee salaries at risk. Now, I've never done that for any group of employees, and I'm not advising that for the state, but I think the comparisons are the exact reverse of the ones that I just heard. I think this is setting way too low a bar for performance appraisal and pay, and the fact that 5% is now in statute under this amendment, you could easily envision contracts going out where 95% of the contract is guaranteed, and I think that is an unbelievably risky proposition for the state. I would never recommend the state enter into a contract where 95% of the billings were guaranteed. I just don't know that I've ever seen one that even comes close to that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you. Representative Downey, why do you continue to misstate the facts? The amendment says at least. I know that you have knowledge of the English language that indicates to you that at least means this much and possibly more. There is nothing in this amendment that gives anybody a guarantee. That is a ridiculous argument. It's silly. It's contrary to the language. It says at least 5%. And you might think that it's not a good number, but it isn't in any way a guarantee of 95% pay. I mean, it's hard to see your argument here as being anything other than anti-public employee. You don't want them to make as much, but you want the contractors to have a separate standard. There's nothing in here at all that talks about a guarantee. It's ridiculous.
Representative Downey, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I said there was a guarantee. I said this language opens up the distinct possibility of a contract where 95% of the payments to that contractor are guaranteed, and in my mind that opens us up to way too much risk in state contracts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to confirm just exactly what Representative Downey is stating, that actually this amendment would be a step backwards from where we're at now. It doesn't help the cause at all and point fingers at trying to make state employees in some manner or form lesser to the process. We have rules and regulations in process now. If a contractor fails on any portion of it, they don't get paid. So there is no need to add additional language. That's the way we do business currently.
Mr. Chair, just
members, if this amendment were offered on the floor, I think there'd be a good case for it not being germane. It's a whole other subject from the main subject of this bill that's before us. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment. I wonder if Representative Stensrud, Representative Benson, Representative Downey have taken the time to review all state contract employees to determine if there's any kind of appraisal or paper performance system. You seem to be quite certain that all contracts with all outside vendors obviously have much more in line, but you haven't really talked about what the state employee bonus system or paper performance system might be. We haven't received a contract all the time. So, we're making broad generalizations. I think the outsourced vendor doesn't want me to make these comments, Mr. Chair. But I'm sure their contract is written so they'll be fully paid anyway, Representative Downey.
For the static you're giving, it's being returned.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is just an equal play amendment. I don't understand why there's any question about this at all. Right. It's a minimum standard.
The request has been made for a roll call on the A2 I assume that I'll be calling for others who want to speak to this bill, but we're going to deal with the amendment here. First of all, could you call the roll on the A2 amendment?
Anderson?
No.
Banyan?
No.
Benson?
No.
Downey?
No.
Gauthier?
Yes.
Green?
Yes.
Gunther?
No.
Hayden? Kahn?
Yes.
Lanning?
No.
Leidiger?
No.
Lilly?
Yes.
Lohmer? McElfetrick?
No.
Murphy?
Yes.
Murray?
No.
Simon?
Yes.
Slawik?
Yes.
Stensrud?
No.
Erdahl?
No.
Winkler?
Yes.
There being 11 no's and 8 yeses, the amendment is not adopted. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard, either for or against this bill? Seeing that no one else wishes to be heard, we will lay over House File 756 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The next bill is House File 418. Thank you, Representative Stensrud. The next bill is House File 418, Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, as Representative Downey is getting ready, I just wanted to offer advice on that last bill that you laid over. And beings that both you and myself served on the Subcommittee on Employee Relations in the last couple sessions, I just want to mention that one of the things that concerned me during my tenure on that committee and was the pay-for-performance, especially with the Minsky system and the problems that were associated with that. And I'm not sure that we really fully dealt with that, and it was a frustration of mine. And I think you had mentioned something similar, and I hope we're careful with some of that, with this bill that we just laid over. Just advice, that's all.
You bet. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 418.
Okay, Representative Downey moves House File 418, and here again, it's our intent to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See if this is the good luck mic. Mr. Chair, members, this bill is actually quite similar to the consolidation of technology functions bill that we heard just a week or so ago now. If you look at Section 2 of the bill, it intends to, at least in its preliminary definition here in this bill, to move the people and the job functions to the Department of Administration relating to accounting, financial reporting, procurement, fleet services, human resources, and payroll services from the existing executive branch agencies. And I might draw your attention to the handout that I provided, which I think gives a pretty decent picture of kind of where the future direction of something like this could lead. The state of Ohio, this is the government technology article, members, and I highlighted or underlined a couple of sentences there. The state of Ohio was in a very similar spot to the state of Minnesota a few years back. They were just on the back end of implementing an enterprise software application system across all of the executive branch agencies for these business functions, and they were looking to transform the way the state was handling certain business processes that software did handled for them to realize the full potential of that software. And those of you who were on this committee 2 years ago heard the comments from Department of Administration and Management and Budget, the folks who would be doing this new SWIFT implementation, the new accounting software implementation, that on the back end of getting a common accounting software platform underneath all of the executive branch agencies, there were numerous benefits to be reaped in terms of common standards, better auditing controls, potential consolidation of functions, all of the things that are right now done in a very distributed and very unique one-off way across all of the executive branch agencies would be on a common business process software platform. And we heard testimony even this year, I believe the project manager's comment was that north of 75%, maybe even 85% of all business processes across the executive branch agency in these areas would be essentially the same, running exactly the same way on this new software platform. So just like Ohio took advantage of that technology platform, and frankly that's the toughest part of this kind of an activity, the fact that the state of Minnesota will have that behind us here on July 1 opens up a really big opportunity, one that I think we should capitalize on. I just want to be clear that this bill doesn't prescribe moving people into all one place or space or you know, getting a new facility or any of those things. What it does is it moves the management oversight responsibility and the budgets and the people into the Department of Administration on the assumption that from there all kinds of consolidation and physical moves and things that could be beneficial to the state from a cost and a controls and a service level standpoint from there. So the second, or actually, I'm sorry, Section 3 in the bill just describes the mechanism. It's the Commissioner of Administration using existing authorities to move those people and then entering into service level agreements with the agencies so that there's some control for the agencies as well, that if they are, quote unquote, losing control of the people, they will still have control over the service that is delivered back to them from this centralized entity. So that is the bill, members. I think there's a huge downstream opportunity for making this first move, the first move that is actually prescribed in the bill. And with that, I would stand for questions. And at some point in time, maybe during the discussion, it might help to take a look at the fiscal note, too. I have a couple of significant questions there, but maybe we'll leave that for discussion as compared to me just going through it.
Questions for Representative Downey? Okay, Representative Ben.
Thank you. Well, I was going to bring up the fiscal note, Representative Downey, anyway, and since you invited the question, I'll walk right in. I'm noting the there's an assumption, a couple assumptions made in this fiscal note that I just looked at. You know, we're just looking at it very briefly, looking at it for the first time here. Could you discuss both the short-run costs of this and the long-run benefits and whether any of the long-run benefits are represented in this fiscal net?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Banyan. You raised a really good point, and I have initiated contact, and I'm trying to schedule a meeting with our new Commissioner Kronk in administration to make sure that I can understand where they were coming from in admin with regard to some of those assumptions. But your point is well taken, Representative Banyan. The savings don't appear to be represented at all here in this bill. And as one who has done some of this kind of work before, typically you'd find all of the costs front-end loaded and then the benefits to be realized in the out years. And again, while we don't prescribe some kind of or the exact timing or the exact structures for how this would occur, my own assumption before getting the fiscal note would have seen some expenses in year one. The effective date of the bill is July 1st of 2011, and in fact in January of 2012 it does say that we need to have a report back from the Commissioner of Administration saying, here's the statutory changes to actually implement everything you are now planning to do as a result of this new consolidation. So my sense is that almost all of the consulting and organizing costs would have been in the first fiscal year, not in years 2, 3, and 4. And I'll draw your attention specifically to a couple of things that don't make sense. And again, I don't want to challenge the fiscal note directly and outright because I just haven't had a chance to have that sit down with the commissioner and really work through this and figure out where they were coming from and what their assumptions were. But on page 5 of the fiscal note, you'll notice there's some costs under the project management heading, and this is where you could expect maybe to peel off some internal individuals, maybe bring in some outside help to do some of this. Costs of $146,000 in 2011, $1.3 million in 2012, and $1.2 million in 2013. Again, that seems like a fairly long duration as compared to doing it more quickly. But then even more curious to me was the fact that we would have three subject matter experts per cabinet agency. Number one, I'm not quite sure how that rolls up to $8 million a year, but then the fact that those costs just continue forever, some of those things just didn't make sense to me. So I guess I share your question marks about the fiscal note. I don't want to say it's not accurate. I don't understand all the assumptions and need to work through that further with the agency.
Representative Banion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Representative Downey, I think we need to have a visit with them, and I do hope you'll go ahead and have a conversation about that. It does seem to me to be quite remarkable to have, it looks like, you know, it says under the internal agency line on page 5 of the fiscal note, $8.158 million in 2012, $7.678 million in 2013, and just judging from the overall number on the first page, it looks like that continues to 2014 as well. So I hope, since I believe we're going to put this is for possible inclusion, that before we get to that point, we have some clarification on that to make sure I understand not just what the short term impact is, because reform has short run costs. We all recognize that, but you know, if those expenditures are going to continue and there's nothing to offset it, you kind of do have to wonder why you're going to do it.
Mr. Chair, just
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Banion, you raise a good point. And again, I think we just need to sit tight until we hear from the administration. It's entirely possible that they're trying to model some of the staff imports, if you will, into their agency and aren't counting at all the savings in the other one. So we just need to sit tight and hear from them and report back on that if we choose to include this in the omnibus bill.
Further questions? Representative Green.
Perhaps to that end, thank you, Chair. I'm sorry. Perhaps to that end, does the Department of Administration, have they had a point of view on this bill, or do they yet?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Green. We had a preliminary discussion on this, I'm going to say 4 or 5 weeks ago, with the governor's staff before the appointment of the new commissioner. And so the new commissioner and I have not had a chance to sit down. We spent some time together on Friday at a separate event and agreed that we needed to meet, and we're in the process of calendaring that. So lots of work to be done. This is something that I think as a concept is embraced and supported, and I think the administration continues to look at it. Whether or not this particular bill and their vision and their timing line up, open question.
No further questions. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard either for or against this bill? Mr. Rhodes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Rhodes, administration. As you know, this is not a department bill. And we have a meeting set up with the commissioner. The commissioner has now been on the job about 4 weeks. And we'll sit down and we'll discuss this with Representative Downey and see what becomes of it until the bill gets rolled out, your omnibus bill gets rolled out. But we are working on, I think next week is when we're scheduled to meet.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Anyone else who wishes to be heard? If not, Representative Downey renews the motion. And I will lay House File 418 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Downey. This is Representative Stensrud's night here. Thank you. Representative Stensrud, welcome, and go ahead and move your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1024.
You may proceed.
All right. House File 1024 really just takes a look at kind of the structure of our state government and how many repetitive deputies and assistant commissioners there are. I learned of a study that was done by the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, and they did a study in the last couple of years and looked at this and actually made a recommendation to streamline some of the upper middle managers and duplication in those different appointed positions. So this bill simply gets rid of a number of those positions and has a fiscal savings of over $5 million. So I think in these times we have to look at all sorts of ways to sort of streamline and get more done with less overhead. And I think since the study was already done and actually brought by the DFL in this past legislature, I think we could probably get some good partisan support. It's something that I think we can all support and save some money.
Representative Stensrud, is the A1 amendment your amendment?
Yes.
You wish to move, move the A1 amendment?
Yeah, I would move the amendment A1.
And you want to speak to it?
Just clarify it. You know, in we tweaked some language, and it just helped clarify. You know, our original intent on those two lines.
Okay. Representative Stensrud moves the A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. The amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the form that the is requested by the author. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Stensrud, I at least want to compliment you for not just picking on employees, but management also. With that, I'll let it go.
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, this is actually a familiar subject. I think we've dealt with it before and fortunately have never passed it. But the what it puzzles me is why you signaled out the Department of Veterans Affairs. I think it's a really small department. Just tell me what was your reasoning for signaling out the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Representative Stensrud.
Why they should have more than one deputy commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I think you know, we took note of how small they were, and we felt that it was important. We thought that was they did a good job. I guess we were looking at them and wanted to hold them harmless, and we felt that, you know, there's a lot being done. I mean, we saw the organization here tonight, and, you know, this with the state veterans homes, you know, we want to make sure that we take care of those who have served for us. So we left them out in that provision.
No. Well, Representative Chairman, I guess I'm not really familiar with the veterans homes, because that used to be in Health and Human Services, but doesn't that have a structure? I mean, it seems to me when you have a small department, the last thing you want to do is make it more top-heavy than a big department. I don't know. I don't know a lot about administration, but I know a little bit about geometry and what pyramids and triangles look like and so forth. And this just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Just tell me how the veterans' homes, what their structure is, and is that a deputy commissioner or an assistant commissioner, or is it just a head of veterans' homes? You know, what's the structure? I assume you've thought this all out, so what is that like?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Kahn. I don't know all of the inner workings of the department.
And I saw this in, Mr. Chairman, I saw this language, and I assumed you knew everything there was to know about it.
Oh, never.
I admitted I've never looked at it before, but that's reasonable because I only saw the bill today. But, okay.
Representative Stensrud.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll let this witness testify.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike McKellen. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And I would just like to speak to the issue of the Veterans Department. Essentially, there are two separate departments. We have our Programs and Services side of the house, and we have the Veterans Home side of the house. So when looking at that, they both fall under the Department of Veterans Affairs because they include the word veteran or the identity of veterans. One is essentially Veterans Homes, which, well, actually is Veterans Homes, which is hospital-type management, nursing home-type management, where the other is Programs and Services, more of a typical business model management. So that's the reason there are those two separate deputy commissioners, because they have two distinct separate functions.
Representative Kahn.
That's the structure right now, and did Veterans Homes come over from where it was with the deputy commissioner over it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. Right now, there are two distinct deputy commissioners.
And what happened? Could you just tell me what the structure of Veterans Homes, was it always in this department and it's just been transferred to this division? Would you just explain to me the structure of it in the government and the structure of it in the legislative appropriations bills? And I apologize for not knowing this, but.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Your name again was?
Mike McKellany.
Please, go ahead.
Representative Kahn, I believe, I know you've been around here much longer than I have, and so I can't speak precisely to how that came about. Initially, the Veterans Homes were not under the purview of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and I understand that they were not managed as well as they could have been, and so at some point they were brought under the purview of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and a nationwide search was conducted for the proper veteran with the right credentials to actually run those Veterans Homes. So I don't know exactly the history that you're looking for, Representative Kahn, but that's how I understand it at this point.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, I believe it was in the Health and Human Services budget, because and I, you know, so I'm just interested in the budget structure and also the department structure. When it was in the Health and Human Services budget, was it in some other department? Was it in the Health and Human Services department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I don't know the
answer
to that.
Does anybody in the room know that?
Take it out. Representative Gunther.
I was on the Veterans Home Board, Mr. Chairman, and when Representative Oscott, the guy from St. Paul, Oscott?
Yes.
Was the chairman of?
Oscott.
Oscott.
I know they're very likely. Oscott was from Lake City.
Okay. That's why I have a problem. The guy from St. Paul.
They looked a lot alike.
No, they didn't. One was twice the other one. But anyway, I was on the Veterans Home Board as an ex-officio member, and they were with the veterans at that time. So that had to be, what, 12 years ago?
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for coming down to clarify that.
Chair.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, I just, on Section 11, the last page of the bill, on page 5 of the bill, I confess I've never seen this in a bill. I've never seen an actual place in statute that sets forth with any detail or particularity like this what exactly you're going to be saving. I've just never seen it. What? Representative Stensrud, if you, or maybe this is a question for Mr. Shepard, I'm having trouble even forming the question. What, I've never seen it written into statute how much money is going to be saved for something. So could either one of you
comment why that's in here. Maybe I just haven't seen it. But
well, we should ask the author first. So, Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simon. And seeing how this is my second official bill, I will admit that I have never seen one of these either, and I would defer to Mr. Shepherd if he could shed some light on this.
Mr. Shepherd. Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm sorry if I got the question correct. It was about the dollars that are in the Section 11.
It's Section 11, yes.
I'm not sure, but I think these dollar amounts are probably from a previous proposal, since this proposal has been traditionally in either the House or Senate bill for several years. I would note that the language here doesn't actually reduce the appropriations to the agencies. And so if you were going to roll this bill into the omnibus bill, we'd want to come up with some language that would actually affect that reduction to appropriations. So if you wanted to count the savings, if you're going to send it out separately, then we might want to think about whether you're going to try and count the savings within this target or let other divisions count those savings.
Representative Simon has still his floor.
Thank you. Well, and actually, this might be a segue, I'm predicting, into what Representative Kahn is going to say. I just, and I'm not, Representative Stensrud, I'm not picking on your bill necessarily. I'm just saying that, you know, as we all know from all the advocates and lobbyists that meet with us, every bill saves the state money, right? So that's kind of the oldest trick in the book that everyone says. Everyone would love to put this in their bill and say, well, my, you know, they could have something for early childhood. I'm looking at Representative Slawick and say, this investment in early childhood will save, you know, Section 11, this investment will save the state X dollars, and have that put in statute. It's just sort of remarkable to me because so many of us, I include myself, claim that bills that we introduce save the state money. You know, whether it's in the area of the judiciary or preventative health services or early childhood or whatever. And I want to be careful that we're not booking savings that are too speculative, because everyone would love to put a provision like this in their bill. I've just never seen it.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, looking carefully at the last page of the bill, I look at Section 10 of the bill, and I look at we're letting corrections. We'll have one, again, let me just state right out, so you may know very much more about this than I do. I know nothing about the Department of Corrections. I've never served on that division, and I usually trust the people who do it. But it just seems to me, from everything that I've read and known about, corrections is a much more complex, much bigger, and much more difficult department than the Department of Veterans Services. So they get one deputy, and Veterans Services get two. I'm not, you know, I'm just interested in that comparison and how you decided it was right to have only one one deputy in corrections, and that Veterans, the comparison that Veterans Services needed two.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn. I mean, there was a rather lengthy study done by MAFE, and when I read through it, it just really, they took a lot of time and put that through. And I think Representative Sertich had proposed these sorts of the structure as well in the previous legislature. So I thought it had a good credibility. And I'm not so proud that I'll admit that I know all about the inner workings and hierarchies of every portion of the state government. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity for me to learn more. But I saw that this was a very credible way to cut some of the middle management, as Representative Gauthier mentioned. You know, I think we should have equal opportunity for savings and reductions in upper management, as well as wherever else we can, you know, streamline and make savings.
Okay. Well, I have,
Representative
Mr. Chairman, I have a lot of problems with these big picture things. I'm much better looking at little small things. So I'm really interested in specifically the comparison of veteran services and corrections. Why one? And as I recall, in the past when we've done this, we've often had some kind of flexibility that you had to get. First of all, it was much broader. We covered many of the political appointments in the departments, and we gave, I think we said, just cut it down by a certain percentage, and we gave the administration a lot of flexibility because we thought that they would be much more likely to know which departments could deal with a unit, a leaner top, and which ones couldn't. And, you know, and so this is, so I'm just really interested in those two departments. Why corrections is okay to only have one, and why veteran services need two. And I don't know if there's been a report that dealt with that.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure of the question.
But it's actually, I mean, the question kind of is the same question I asked again. You know, do you know so much about these two departments that you're very confident to say that Veterans Services needs two and Corrections needs one? And then the question behind that is, I'd like to see the arguments that go into it instead of just an opinion, that we need to cut the top down. And when you referred to Representative Sertich's motion, and again, you know, since we didn't do this, I'm not completely sure about how we, you know, how we kept it, how we kept it in place. But the example is, I thought that we usually gave some kind of flexibility in doing this. We never eliminated all of them, understanding that the administration of departments is kind of complex, and that much as however smart we think we are, that we might want to give the department, the administration, some flexibility in deciding where they needed a heavier top. So that's the question.
So is there a question you're
wanting? Yeah, the question is, why are you doing
all
this?
Right,
why are you doing this specifically? And we didn't seem to get a specific answer, so I just gave it as a request to have that answered in the future. I assume that we're not going to have, that when we get an omnibus bill before us, it's not going to have all these things in just as they are, so... Or we're going to have some vote on whether they're going to be included in the omnibus bill at the end. So
sweet.
I'm just asking for more information. Is that allowed?
It certainly is. Representative Stensrud, do you have a further comment about the question or response to the question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, I would be happy to get further information. I think if we lay this over for inclusion, you know, I would have a great willingness to consider. You know, if we need to have some leeway, I think, you know, we're open to considering that and listening to those arguments.
Okay. That question will be given further study. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, this is one of those bills that has had many generations over the years, kind of depending on apparently who the governor is. So it's one of those that we have all either voted for or against at one time or another. And, you know, look forward to, as we go through this, you know, making some changes, coming up with something that perhaps we can all vote for again.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to Representative Kahn's point about the Department of Corrections, and by no means do I pretend to be an expert, but... In public safety, it's very clear DOC is divided in major divisions of community corrections and then prisons. And it would seem to me, Representative Stensrud, that maybe we need to take a look about that, why it's laid over, because there are two distinct different functions going on there.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Stensrud, it looks like there's maybe a little assumed flexibility in here more than perhaps Representative Kahn's question presented to us. If you look at page 8 of your fiscal note to this bill, under the assumptions, Department of Transportation notes that according to statute, they still need the employees currently designated as assistant commissioners. So they would simply be converted to a different classification according to their assumption. Is that assumption correct, and would that apply more generally?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Banyan. In that specific
example. I know we did change the language so that we wouldn't just change titles and classifications. I mean, our intent was really to net some reductions in you know, the staff positions and not just reclassify them. And I would probably ask, in this particular instance, I might defer to Mr. Shepherd if he would be able to clarify that on that statute.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, I am looking at the statute now, and it doesn't really answer the question definitively, so I would need to consult with the author and others and provide information later.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. So the same thing applies over on page 10. I mean, this is slightly different, but they have deputy commissioners. This is for let me double check. This is for Department of Commerce. They've got deputy commissioners, assistant commissioners for all kinds of divisions and offices, and they give us some lovely language about how needed all these people are, and yet they go ahead and make the reduction. So I think the answer either has to be we're going to be okay with them finding some accommodation to meet the requirements here. I don't know this is as much of a straitjacket as it may sound from some of the questions, but let me ask you again, if we're not allowed to move people around out of a commissioner title to something else, let me say it differently. If we are allowed to move people around, where does the savings come from? And if we're not allowed to move people around, are these notes really being accurate in these assumptions that they're making?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Banyan. No, I think the assumption is that we would eliminate these positions and that we would end up, you know, not just reassigning them. It would be fruitless, I guess, to just eliminate the positions without actually, you know, netting a savings.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So, those people do functions, right? They're not just drinking coffee. So, we do expect that they're doing something that's useful. And your understanding is then that those functions they perform are simply delegated back to folks that currently work there, but just aren't called commissioners.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan. Yes. You know, you would reshuffle those duties as done across America when you make, you know, some strategic cutbacks. You reassign duties and move on and continue.
Representative Gunther.
I was just going to tell Representative Kahn that with the veterans, it's a matter of geography that they need two commissioners, not geometry, because you look at all the veterans' homes, all of the veterans' hospitals, all of the veterans' service centers, and veterans' homes for the homeless. It's throughout the whole state, and just to get to all of them would take one assistant commissioner.
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, I think my point is the people that you need getting to them are not usually the assistant commissioner types. The people who do the work are kind of the people that are lower down, and the people, you know, we can just say, well, look at DNR, they're 87 state parks, got to have probably five deputy commissioners or something like that to take care of all of that. That's the issue. It seems to me that the size of the top ought to relate to the size of the department. That's just the general thing. And it also seems to me that the grocery clerks and the legislature shouldn't make those kinds of decisions. It's much better off being made by
grocery?
Some
but I
top.
Was. I was
sorry, I was using
I
that as a general
term.
I was using that as just a general term.
But the owner clerk.
No. But the point is the hands-on people shouldn't be making those kinds of decisions.
I think hands-on supervision is very necessary.
Not at the assistant commissioner level, is what I'm saying.
Representative Stensrud, I assume that well, I know, given the dates here, that Section 11 was drafted before you had the fiscal note, and the fiscal note has a much bigger number. Do you want to comment on that? If we were to put this kind of language in the bill, do you want it to reflect the fiscal note, or are you satisfied with $3.9 million?
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'm actually comfortable with either one of those numbers. It seems to be a pretty big number, but I did receive the updated fiscal note just today, so I haven't had a chance to study it nor compare and contrast which number it is, but I would love to do that and have a better, more definitive answer soon.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Gauthier.
Just a point. Thank you, Chair Lanning. This was the Sertich bill. It was not a MAPE bill. And I want to make clear that MAPE wasn't advocating for a bill, even though they did a study on deputy commissioners. And I just want that point note. This is not a MAPE bill against deputy commissioners.
Representative Benson.
No, it might, should be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Stensrud. This is a bill, however, that you really do want to be able to book a savings for.
Representative Stensrud.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, absolutely.
So we need to make sure then that it's clarified that indeed if a deputy commissioner position is abolished, that they can stay in the agency in a currently held vacant or open position, but they won't be added by giving a make work position. Is that correct?
Representative Stensrud.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Anyone in the audience? Seeing that no one wishes to be heard, Representative Stensrud renews his motion, and we will lay over House File 1024 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, a couple of words about Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just noticed something on Representative Downey's handout, which the committee might want to know. His one pager on government technology. There's what looks to be an ad there, or a link, or something. If you still have it, some of you may have discarded it. It says 25 government technology top 25 doers and dreamers, I think it is. I better remember the doers part, and if I'm not mistaken, I think Representative Kahn was one of those. Representative Kahn, do I have the year right? Or was this?
That's it, right in that
you area. Actually? Okay, I thought.
Right.
All right, just so everyone knows. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Members, a word about the schedule. Tomorrow,
interesting.
We have some more overviews, budget overviews, and we will also have some on Wednesday with one bill. Representative Banyan's bill will be on the docket for Wednesday. Thursday evening, we will have committee meeting, and we'll finish up any bills that are yet to come before us for consideration. We will meet again 30 minutes or thereabouts after session on Thursday. Our goal here is to have the bill released on Monday morning in order that we can present the bill on Tuesday morning and start receiving testimony and testimony again on Wednesday. And I want to be able to mark up the bill and finish the markup on Thursday morning of next week, so that and we will have an opportunity to meet all morning, I understand, if we need to. Start at 8:15, and we will be able to extend up until the noon hour if we need to, in order to mark up the bill. So that's the plan, and pardon me? Yeah. I'm reminded that the meeting on both Wednesday and Thursday will start at 8 o'clock. So please make sure that that you make that change adjustment on your schedule. With that, we're adjourned.